Good evening and welcome. It is a great privilege to have Rabbi Chaim Angel with us again. To be recorded, I guess. Shabbos was not possible to record except in our minds, which took us the main place to record it. Rabbi Angel is National Scholar of the Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals. I'm not going to go this whole resume. This is a short resume. We got it mailed some while ago. But really, he speaks for himself quite eloquently, so I think we need all that introduction. I would like just to do several other dual thank yous. Thank you to Michael Yael Schreiber for sponsoring this week's lecture in memory of Michael's father, Stanley Schreiber, Zachariah Ben Azriel Aryeh, who is close to his neshama. We'd also like to thank the sponsors of the other weeks, John and Marion Gessler Kramer, Harold Fandiller, the Paul family, and Avram Sharon Blumenthal. So this is part of a 3-week series. Today's on Mishlei, next week on EO, the week after is the Kohelet. And you have from Monday to Shabbos to try and make place in your brain for the next Sefer of Wisdom. Those who heard of Angel either here for Shabbos or read his works or heard him on any occasion know that he is really a Mayan Mitgaber, a great strength and an overflowing amount of information, knowledge, and insight about Tanakh in a way that we for sure didn't learn in elementary school. Maybe some of us were lucky enough to have a smattering in high school or college or beyond, but certainly we have numerous students at various institutions, including Kosher University, where if you ask them who they take for Tanakh, they take Rabbi Angel. They may take somebody else because they get closed out, but they take Rabbi Angel. That's really kind of the way it is, and that we're very privileged to have him with us. I'd like to also just mention that in the back of the room is Rabbi Alec Goldstein, who is president of Kodesh Press, who is republishing Rabbi Angel's book Through an Opaque Lens, which is described as widely refracted through eternal rabbinic wisdom, which I guess is what we're in for this evening also as well. So we really thank Rabbi Angel for taking the time to share his insights with us, and we appreciate it very much, and enjoy the evening. I'm sure there'll be questions at the end.
Thank you, Rabbi Hochberg. I don't know if this microphone is going to help me or hinder me, but I'm going to do my best. It's really an honor and privilege and pleasure to be back. So thank you so much for having me. I want to thank Rabbi Hochberg, of course, Marad Atra, as well as Avi Freilich for arranging everything and for being so welcoming about the whole thing. It's also always amazing to me when people come out to learn Tanakh. There's been such a thirst in our community for it, and it's a pleasure to see more chairs coming out as we speak. I've never given this 3-part series before, so I'm delighted to be able to come out to Young Israel of Jamaica State to begin a process with you. And some of it's personal, and I'll share a little bit of the personal element of it. I used to love Mishlei. The 3-part series is Mishlei today, and then Iyov, followed by Kohelet. And the way that you're supposed to teach adult education, at least having done it for some time, is you want to make sure that each lecture stands on its own, because people are busy and they can't always make it, or they have a wedding or a bar mitzvah or something, so you don't want to ruin it for them. On the other hand, of course, you want the collective to be much better than if you just came to one or the other. So I'm hoping to achieve that in this 3-part series. I used to really love Mishlei. I thought it was just grand. When I was in yeshiva in Israel after high school, I fell in love with it. I began to have chavruta with it with all these different people. I couldn't wait to come back to YU, and the very first text course I signed up for was Mishlei. And then I was just sitting there, you know, bated breath, couldn't wait to hear what the teacher was going to say. And the teacher was very competent, and he did a very good Rav Hirshian job. The way Rav Hirsch wrote his commentary on Mishlei was to break it up into categories. Here are some verses about friendship, and here are some verses about love, and here are some verses about Sachar Va'onesh, reward and punishment, all of that. And he gave us these good lists and quoted some of the verses and went through some of the structure of the verses. And no slight to this teacher, I was bored to death. I really was, and I was kicking myself. I'm like, I came from Mishlei, I love the book, right? And I'm bored, and I couldn't figure out what my problem was. So I said, you know, I'm going to have to give this another whirl. So in graduate school, lo and behold, I had another opportunity to take a course in Sefer Mishlei by a different teacher with a totally different style. His whole thing was trying to show the connection between verses, because if you've read Mishlei, even on a superficial level, you will find that chapters 1 through 9 is pretty much a coherent unit, and after that it kind of gets very scattered. Meaning, from verse to verse, you cannot always tell, but why is verse 12 right after verse 11? In fact, you have no clue. And not only do you have no clue, neither do I, and neither does our Parshanut. And our Mefarshim spend a lot of time, Rav Menachem HaMeiri, the great Meiri in the 13th century, already wrote, not always sure if there is supposed to be a connection here, but let's at least try. Which I think is a very honest response to what's really going on from chapters 10 through most of 31. There's a lot of scattered verses. So this teacher was trying to go through different approaches to how to link that verse to the next guy. And even though this teacher is a master educator and a phenomenal scholar, I found myself bored to tears again. So I wrote a term paper. I figured, okay, maybe at least in a term paper I have a shot. I wrote a 51 page long, it's much easier to write 51 pages, you know, than to write a 10 page paper. That's what I learned in graduate school. You do the research and then you just bang it out and you don't need to filter. That was great. So in the meantime, so I did that. I wrote a 51 page paper on Rav Pinchas of Plotsk and his commentary on Mishlei. Rav Pinchas of Plotsk was some Talmud of the Gra. Never heard of him before, but my teacher suggested that I should look him up. I found him, wrote it in the early 1800s, and I was fascinated by his work, but usually I got into my term papers. Here, I'm afraid to say, I was really not that excited about it. I just did it, banged out all of his interpretations, was not sure why I had just done that. And then at some point came the soul-searching thing of, why am I having such a problem with Mishlei? And you know, I'm teaching in my 36th semester now at Yeshiva College, and I've gone through most of Nach because, you know, you teach there long enough, there's only a limited number of books, and each semester you get another Sefer. And I've never taught Mishlei. By choice. I figured, here are two excellent teachers, and they couldn't find a good way to do it for me. So, okay, so what's my alternative? And I haven't yet found one. And so what I wanted to do is explore what Mishlei is tonight. And then over the next 3 weeks, really look through different takes or slants within biblical wisdom, what we, you know, the three great wisdom Sfarim of Tanakh, and to try to explore what makes Mishlei its own sefer, what makes it so distinctive, what makes Iyov so distinctive, and what makes Kohelet so distinctive. Mishlei starts off, we have in Sefer Merachim, we all have source sheets, by the way, there were some made and they were on the back table over there. Who's the author of Sefer Mishlei? Shlomo HaMelech, right? And he's already famed in Sefer Melachim for being very wise. Vayidaber shloshet alafim mashal. Vayhi shiro chamisha va'alef. So Shlomo is famed for making 3,000 proverbs. It's quite a lot of them. The whole book of Mishlei, by the way, is just 915 psukim. So you understand that whatever Shlomo did, not all of his Mishalim made it into Sefer Mishlei. Meaning Mishlei has some of his material, but certainly not all. Now, our Sefer, if you've never really learned it, you can see right away that there are introductory verses or superscriptions or title verses scattered throughout the Sefer. You have at the very beginning, and this is how you all knew it was Shlomo, in source number 2, the very first pasuk in Sefer Mishlei. Mishlei Shlomo ben David Melech Yisrael. So right away, you expect this whole book is going to be Shlomo HaMelech. And you begin to read, and you go, and you go, and you go. And again, the first 9 chapters are a teacher or a parent talking to a child saying why wisdom is good for you. It's an amazing slant. It's totally different from anything we've seen thus far in Tanakh. But a teacher or a parent is speaking to a child saying wisdom is really, really good for you and it will help you to avoid certain pitfalls along the way. And that covers chapters 1 through 9. Then you get to chapter 10 and lo and behold, in source number 3, what do we see? Mishlei Shlomo. Well, I knew that already, didn't you? What's this Mishlei Shlomo again? Mishlei Shlomo, Ben Chacham Yisamach Av, and so on and so forth. There's another title verse here. And that introduces, obviously, a different section. And what's different between this section and everything that comes after it is that, again, there's a very loose confederation of psukim, so loose that it's hard to tell. The standard quip or joke, or it's just a truism, however you want to think about it, I always have a sense of humor about these things, but I think that it's actually true. If you're learning Sefer Tehillim, you can pretty much really work at it and figure out what a mizmor is about, but you don't know why this mizmor is next to that other one. Right? You don't know what the connection necessarily is between one mizmor and the next. In Mishlei, that is true from one pasuk to the next, and in Iyov, it's between one word and the next. Right? In other words, that Iyov is one of the other three sfarim that I've never taught, you know, and for different reasons. Mishlei, because I haven't thought of a good way to teach it as a text course yet. Iyov, because I don't know what the words mean, so it's just a bad idea to teach a text course. I love teaching the ideas behind it, and that's what we'll do with excerpts, but to go 13 shiurim in a row, I haven't figured out a way to do that, and Daniel for a host of other reasons. And so those are the three that I still long to try my hand at, and maybe our shiurim here tonight and over the next few weeks will inspire me to give it another shot. Well, that introductory verse, chapter 10, verse 1, or Perek Yud Pasuk Aleph, carries us through a whole loose confederation of Mishalim all the way through chapter 24. And then something amazing happens. Source 4, we have beginning of Perek Kafei, chapter 25. Gam Ela Mishlei Shlomo. These also are Shlomo's proverbs. Asher Ha'atiku Anshei Chizkiyah Melech Yehuda. Who is Chizkiyah? They were transcribed or copied over by the men of Chizkiyah. Who is Chizkiyah? He's a king, right? When did he live? In terms of, here Shlomo, is Chizkiyah before, during, after? He's way after, correct. He's centuries later. Shlomo is the beginning of the dynasty, of course. There's David, then Shlomo. Chizkiyah is towards the end of Melachim Bet. There's not that much more to go after that. It's a couple of centuries later. So, what's up with that? If Shlomo is the author of our Sefer, where's Chizkiyah coming, and his school, whatever this group of people is, where are they coming from? Who are they, and what are they doing here? In fact, you should know that even though, you know, when I asked who wrote Mishlei, many of you right away jumped out and said, well, of course, it's Shlomo. And you're right, Pasuk Aleph says so. That's a pretty good bet. That's our traditional ascription. But if you look at the Talmudic passage, the only one in all of Shas that deals with authorship of biblical books, source number 5 over here, when it comes to Mishlei, it's very interesting what it says here. Chizkiyahu v'siyato kadvu. Notice how they're drawing off of our Pasuk in Mishlei. Chizkiyahu wrote Yeshayah. Now Chizkiyahu is a contemporary of Yeshayahu, by the way. Mishlei, Shir HaShirim, v'Kohelet. The three books that are ascribed to Shlomo HaMelech, the only passage in all of Shas that tackles the issue of authorship in any way, says that it was Chizkiyahu. And that's based entirely on this verse that we just looked at. Because Mishlei has some process of transcription. When it says Katvu, what does Katvu mean?
Put it down on paper.
Put it down on paper means, where was it before?
All.
So it could be, why is that such an intriguing and appealing interpretation of the verse? How do you know it doesn't mean authored?
Shlomo.
Oh, it's a good way of hanging on to both. You can say Shlomo authored the verses, but it was some kind of Torah Shebe'al Peh, that it was orally transmitted from generation to generation, and it was only Chizkiyahu and his school that finally transcribed it. Now, very good. Let's assume that that is correct, and that I think is a fair reading of what the Talmud is saying, because the Talmud knows that Shlomo is behind those three books, Shir HaShirim, Mishlei, and Kohelet. Now, what are the options of Chizkiyahu v'siyato's role? Did they have a full Sefer Mishlei the way that you and I have it and just put pen to paper, although I'm sure that they were right-handed despite my left-handed gesture? I always make that mistake. It kills me. But in the meantime, what can I do? All these years I've learned to deal with it. But in the meantime, did Chizkiyahu v'siyato have some complete form of Mishlei which had just been memorized and transmitted through the generations? Or did they have all kinds of Mishalim, and they just decided, they were the ones who decided what order to put them in? Or did they have more of an active role in the process, such as adding stuff or giving commentary to it? We have this centuries-long process of transmission between Shlomo until Chizkiyahu. And Avot Rabbeinu Natan, the ancient Perush on Pirkei Avot, already from the time of the Amoraim, grapples with what is the role of Anshei Chizkiyah and other later groups such as Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. Havu Mishnin Badin, source number 6. Ketad. So it starts off with the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, the very first one. But you need to be patient in judging. It's a good thing to be patient in judgment. They didn't just transcribe it. They were patient. Abasha ulomer, lo shehim tinu, it's not just that they waited, ela sheperishu, that they interpreted it. So according to Abba Shaul, Chizkiyahu v'siyato had some active input into the Sefer. It's not necessarily that they simply transcribed something that had been in oral tradition. It could very well be that they took a much more active role in this process. What we care about from a traditional point of view, and Abarbanel points this out all over his Perush on Tanakh, is that the Sefer that we have in front of us is written Beruach HaKodesh. It's less essential to us whether is this Pasuk really Shlomo? Is it oral Shlomo written Chizkiyahu? Is it oral Shlomo written Chizkiyahu with interpretation of Chizkiyahu, or even if Anshei Knesset HaGedolah has some kind of role in this? What matters to us is that there's some Beit Midrash of wisdom that's going on in ancient Israel, and that the final product that we have in front of us is written Beruach HaKodesh. Okay. So the Chizkiyahu pasuk gives us a whole new dimension into what we're looking at when we read Sefer Mishlei. And then you get the Perek Lamed. Here's all the stuff tucked away at the back that even if you're learning it straight, it takes you a while to get over there, because again, it's only 31 prakim long. And source number 7 says, Divrei Agur Ben Yake. Here are the words of Agur Ben Yake. Now, what you don't see here is Shlomo. Right? Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, just has Mishlei Shlomo. Fine. Perek Yud, same deal. Mishlei Shlomo. Kaf Hei has Mishlei Shlomo with this little thing about Chizkiyahu, which opens up some world into the Sefer. Who in the world is Agur Ben Yake? And then there's some other names over here. Amasa Neum HaGever Li'itiel. Who's Itiel? Li'itiel V'Ukal. And now there's somebody else now. Ukal too. Who are these people? So here, tradition has interesting ways of reckoning with random names that appear without any identification in the Sefer that's so obviously Shlomo's. One approach is, ride with this, these are nicknames of Shlomo HaMelech. Right? In other words, that's one possibility. It could very well be. Then you have to explain why they are. By the way, Rashi and Rashbam like the name Agur. What does Agur mean? Something to do with collect or gather, right? And isn't there some other Sefer ascribed to Shlomo that sounds a little bit like that? Maybe Kohelet, yeah. Right? Kohelet also sounds like gatherer. So Rashi and Rashbam make that link. That Agur is a nickname of Shlomo, the same as Kohelet is, and they both have something to do with gathering, either gathering wisdom personally, or gathering crowds of people together to hear his wisdom, however you wish. And so that's a tempting way of looking at it. But there are other Mefarshim that say, no, the reason why you hear Agur Ben Yake here and Itiel and Ukal is because these are different people. Right? So Rav Sadia Gaon already says that Rav Moshe Kimchi, who is the much less famous brother of Rav David Kimchi, a.k.a. Radak, but still a brilliant Parshan, I feel it's amazing, of the Kimchi family, Rav Yosef Kimchi, who was the father, phenomenal Parshan, and Rav Moshe Kimchi, the older brother, was likewise a phenomenal Parshan, but they were so vastly eclipsed by Radak. So most of us have heard of Radak. He's one of the greatest Mefarshim who ever lived. He's pretty much eclipsed the Kimchi name. But it's important to know that Rav Yosef and Rav Moshe actually were incredibly important Parshanim in their own right. In the meantime, Rav Moshe Kimchi, following Rav Sadia Gaon and the Gra also, and several others along the way, say, the reason why it says Divrei Agur Ben Yake is because there's somebody else. You want to hear a really interesting one? There's somebody who's much less famous than all of that. His name is Rav Avraham Ben Yaakov Gavishon. He was an Algerian rabbi who also was a doctor, like many other people who somehow found the time to do both. I have a really hard time even with just one of those things. But some of these great rabbis were able to do both. Rav Avraham Ben Yaakov Gavishon in 16th century Algeria was one such individual. He wrote a perush on Mishlei. He suggests that these people are non-Jews. And specifically, these were non-Jews who studied at Shlomo HaMelech's feet. The idea is that Shlomo HaMelech taught wisdom, and as we see in Tanakh already, people came from all over the place to hear it. So he had some disciples. Some people left their homelands wherever they were, and got so into it that they stayed and absorbed his wisdom, and their names appear. And likewise, the same thing shows up in source number 8. We're going to go back to that point, not because we can tell biographically whether these people were Jews or non-Jews. It's important to know that some great rabbinic figure in our past who wrote a Perush on Mishlei was convinced that these individuals were non-Jewish. And that says something about the nature of Sefer Mishlei, which is what I want to get to in just a moment. But before we do, the last parak is source number 8, Divrei Lemuel Melech Masa. Well, who's he? In fact, he sounds like he's even a king of some other place, which is probably what triggered Rav Gavishan to imagine that here's a king from a place called Masa. This country appears in Sefer Bereishit, by the way. It is a place in Tanakh. Who was so impressed by Shlomo HaMelech that he came over, studied his wisdom, and then said some wisdom, and that is included in Sefer Mishlei as well. If you don't want to say that he's from a place called Masa, you can say Divrei Lemuel Melech. And Masa, Asher Yisar Tel Yimo, this is something that his mother rebuked him, rather than Masa, the name of the place. But either way, what we see, and by the way, here's the most famous part of Sefer Mishlei, we would probably all agree on this, is the very end of it, the Eshet Chayil. It's in Perek Lamed Aleph, which means, at least according to the outlining that we've seen over here, it's in Lemuel's mouth, whoever he is. Right, you know, most people would say, oh, it's from Mishlei, therefore it must be Shlomo, whereas in fact Sefer Mishlei explicitly seems to indicate that it's this man named Lemuel who might be a non-Jewish king from this place called Masa, and several Mifarshim along the way assume that as well. What I care about for our purposes is that we've seen that there are five definite superscriptions. There are five introductory verses in our Sefer. And that means that there are five sections, at least. Well, some people think there are even more, and it's important to figure out how this all works and why this is all important, other than, since this is an overview issue, I think it's my obligation to go over what these sections are. In the Dat Mikra, the Mosad Rav Kook Perush, there are several other psukim that they themselves are convinced are separate introductions, but several Mifarshim along the way agree with them. Source number 9, which is in the middle of the second major section, it says, Hat oz nechal shma divrei chachamim v'libchat ashit ledati. When I read it, and before I read it, Rav Yosef Ibn Nachmias, one of the great 14th century commentaries on Sefer Mishlei, just says that here is Shlomo telling us that we should listen to wise people. It's not a new section. But there are those along the way who said, no, Shema Divrei Chachamim is actually an introduction to, here are some proverbs from other wise people, not Shlomo anymore. In other words, the Shlomo part stops right before this pasuk. And now we have Divrei Chachamim. And similarly, in source number 10, Gam Eile LaChachamim. And these also are from the Chachamim. Which again, some say has nothing to do with the new section, rather it's just why people should do these things. But there are some along the way, and Dat Mikra is convinced that this is another section of proverbs by anonymous sages, rather than by Shlomo. There's one other section which I think is very curious that comes up, and that's in the middle of Perek Lamed, which is the Agur Perek, in source number 11. It says La'aluka, which probably just means a leech, that kind of thing that you really don't want to get on you while you're swimming in a lake. Right? So in the meantime, that's how most Mifarshim understand this aluka. But Rabbeinu Tam already in Masachet Avodah Zarah, and a couple of Mifarshim along the way, imagine that aluka is actually the name of another person. La'aluka means here are the proverbs of Aluka. We had Agur, now we have Aluka, and later on we're going to have Lemuel. So these are mini sections of other people. And Dat Mikra supports that view. They think that it has more to do with another section by somebody named Aluka. And finally, Dat Mikra argues that Eshet Chayil, which is at the end, is not part of the Lemuel section, but rather it is a separate section, and therefore they think that there are 9. However, other scholars disagree with that whole approach and say, no, the Divrei Chachamim stuff, this is still Shlomo, and it just means listen to sages. Eshet Chayil does not have a separate title, and therefore it does not belong there, and that means there are 5. I'm actually much more satisfied with the 5 approach, because the other ones do seem to be a little flimsier. Aluka seems to be a leech rather than the name of a person. Well, so there are 5 sections in Sefer Mishlei. Does that sound familiar to other biblical books that also might have 5 sections? Well, you have the Torah, right? But there's another one. Well, Megillah, there are 5 Megillah, but actually there's no group. There's no official thing called Megillot other than since we read them on holidays in shul, so they've become the five Megillot. In other words, they have a separate category, but there's no one super book called Megillot other than what you buy in a Sfarim store because they put it together for us out of for convenience. But Tanakh doesn't see Megillot as a category. But there's another sefer in Tanakh that is broken up into five traditional sections besides the Torah, and that is Tehillim. Tehillim actually has five books. We call it Sefer Tehillim. But if you open up any traditional copy of Tehillim, you will see, you know, chapters 1 through 41 is book 1, and 42 through 72 is book 2, and so on and so forth. There are five books of Tehillim. Now, I find that very interesting because that seems to be deliberate. If you can imagine that the Torah is broken up into five books, Tehillim is broken up into five books, and Mishlei is broken up into five books. Torah is God's voice to people, right? It's God revealing His voice to us. What's Tehillim? The other way around, right? It's the only Sefer in Tanakh that's people's voice to God. And what's Mishlei? It's a wise person to other people. There's three different styles of teaching in Tanakh. And the paradigms of each one, you have the Torah, which is, of course, that's everything. Without the Torah, the rest of them don't matter as much. But you have the Torah, which is the epicenter of it all, namely revelation, which is God's voice to us. Tehillim is the epitome of prayer, which is people's voices to God, and Mishlei is five books or five subsections of one wise sage giving wisdom to others. Which brings us to the important point about Mishlei. There's some proverb about, you know, take a drink between sections of a shiur. I'm sure. Let's go back to Rav Gavi Shon's point that he thinks that Agur and Etl and Ukal and Lemuel are non-Jews. Whether or not they are, I'm fine if they're Jews too. But why can he say that? Not how can he say that, it's fine. There's no reason why it couldn't be non-Jews either writing Baruch HaKodesh or that they wrote and it was included in Baruch HaKodesh. There's no religious issue with this, although it would be curious. If you open a Sefer Mishlei and start to read it and you don't know you're reading Sefer Mishlei, most of the time you wouldn't be sure that it's a Jewish book. It's good stuff, you know, it's good Musar and everything, but if you read A Stitch in Time Saves Nine, it's all good stuff. What you find is that most of Sefer Mishlei is absolutely universal. In fact, all of Sefer Mishlei is absolutely universal in the sense that there is nothing about Jews or about the Torah the way that we observe it. There's nothing about our national history. Anybody could read Sefer Mishlei and not have to translate what Israel means. The only time Israel appears is at the beginning of the Sefer. That's already important. And scholars have already long pointed out. Now we have other wisdom books from other countries, from other traditions. Mesopotamian wisdom, Egyptian wisdom. Sometimes the parallels between these collections are uncanny. So uncanny that there seems to be some borrowing or influence. You can imagine that sages are sharing wisdom. It could be that we're influencing them. It could be that they're influencing us, and it's getting around. And the only psukim that if we just have all these collections of wisdom next to each other, the only psukim that we would know, oh, a Jew wrote this one, is if Shem Hashem is there. Because then, okay, nobody else is saying Yudkei Vavkei, so this belongs to us. But lots of the other psukim, while of course very wise and applicable, and we should live by their guidance, but we would never know. We would really never know that it was written by Shlomo HaMelech or by any Jew unless we had the whole book in front of us and then we could see. And that brings us to, on the one hand, obviously there was a lot of wisdom influence going on in the ancient world. But there are differences, as Zat Mikra likes to point out and as other, you know, contemporary commentators like to point out as well. One thing which is incredibly different between Mishlei and all the other wisdoms that were out there, all the other wisdom literatures. Wisdom literature in Egypt and Mesopotamia was for the sages. The idea is that there's an elite group of wise people, and that's what these Mishalim, that's what this wisdom is for. Not Mishlei. Mishlei is for all of us. Well, we're all wise, of course, but I'm saying Mishlei is for all Jews. There's no sense whatsoever that this teaching or these teachings belong to some elite group. A similar thing, by the way, is Tzelem Elohim, one of the most important teachings of the Torah in general and a centerpiece of our whole religious philosophy. We didn't invent the concept, meaning the existence of the term in the image of the name of some god or the image of the gods or so on and so forth predates Matan Torah. The difference is that in Egypt, where you had stuff like this, it was always the king. The king was in the image of the gods. They're not regular people, and certainly not non-Egyptians, forget about it. Right? Whereas the whole point of the Torah is everybody is created B'Tzelem Elohim. The chidush of the Torah, in which Mishlei picks up as well, is that Torah is for everybody, and Mishlei, wisdom, is for everybody. So even if we're teaching similar things often, not always, but there's one very important difference, that there is no elitism. That's point number one. Point number two is that Mishlei breaks rank from Egyptian wisdom. Egyptian wisdom likes righteous behavior, however it wishes to define it, but it does not see knowledge as a precondition or a guarantor of righteousness, meaning you could be very educated and still be a rotten person. You know, the questions come up when you have these philosophy professors of ethics who are just rotten, evil scoundrels. Is that a paradox? Right? So people talk about these things. Whether so they'll say, look, I'm an excellent scholar in the field of philosophical ethics, but that has nothing to do with my personal conduct. Mishlei doesn't go for that. Okay? Mishlei says, wisdom doesn't just mean knowing the right thing to do. Wisdom means knowing the right thing to do and then doing it. Right? In other words, we see the wisdom as a necessary component of righteous behavior, meaning if you are wise, you will always make the right choice, or at least know what the right choices are. So far we see two differences. One is that Mishlei is non-elitist, meaning it's for everybody, whereas ancient Near Eastern wisdoms were just very elitist. And second of all, Mishlei believes that righteousness comes with wisdom, and has to come with wisdom, whereas Egyptian wisdom, for example, thought it would be nice if wise people also were righteous, if they were good people, but it doesn't have to be that way at all. If you want to look at a couple of very interesting examples that illustrate the points that I'm trying to bring out in dramatic fashion, well, funny enough, I have them right here in the source sheet, in sources 12, 13, and 14, to make the point. B'tach el Hashem b'chol libecha, in source number 12. El binatcha al kisha'in. For Mishlei, for Jewish wisdom, wisdom is not self-sufficient. Trust in God is what is a becomes a prerequisite for wisdom, which again separates Mishlei's wisdom from all other wisdoms. It's really important to appreciate how much Yirat Shamayim is at the heart and soul of our wisdom, rather than either an independent variable, as in the case of Egypt, or even where wisdom comes first. Yirat Shamayim is expected to be at the very base of all later wisdom. If you want to see that what I was talking about before within Sefer Mishlei of Yirat Shamayim, clearly Jewish psukim versus things that could have gone anywhere, you see juxtapositions throughout Sefer Mishlei. I just gave two examples for the sake of time, but again, this is supposed to be an introductory shiur. Go out and learn all 31 prakim after we are done, and hopefully it will just jump out of you every single time. It's amazing how that works. Source number 13. Tov me'at b'yirat Hashem. It's good to have just to be poor, but to be a Yirat Shamayim. Me'otzar rav mehumabo. Rather than having a ton of money, but being either confused or having chaos. So that seems like a nice Jewish proverb, right? In other words, the idea is that it's better to be religious and poor than to be wealthy and having a messed up life. And look at the very next pasuk. Tov aruchat yarach da'ava sham. It's better to have a vegetarian meal. Chas v'shalom, right? It's better to have a vegetarian meal, but at least when there's love around the table. Mishor avus, instead of having fatted ox. Oh, so good, I'm drooling just thinking about it. Visinabo, but to have contention at the table. Now it goes without saying, here you see Baruch HaKodesh, carnivory is good. But it also, this second pasuk could have been said by anybody, right? In other words, this could have been said by a Mesopotamian. It could have been said by an Egyptian. In other words, the idea, it's a very nice lesson. It's a good lesson, right? The idea is that it's good to have peace in your home and a lesser meal than to have a very lavish meal, but to have contention. Anybody could have said that. Any wise person might come to the same conclusion. But look at the juxtaposition. They're both about, it's better to be poor and X than to be rich and Y. But the first one is, it's better to be poor and a Yirat Shamayim than rich and chaotic. And the second one is a generic pasuk, meaning any culture could have said the same thing. And here you see the sense of Sefer Mishlei taking ancient Near Eastern wisdom, because the second pasuk sounds like it could have belonged to anybody, and putting its gushpanka on it, putting its own stamp, its own Yirat Shamayim way of thinking about things. Similarly, in source number 14 in Parashat Yedchet, Migdal Oshem Hashem Boyerus Linizgav. What is a great fortress? Yirat Shamayim, fear of God. That's where every tzaddik, that's where every righteous person will take refuge in God. And the very next pasuk, Ho Nashir Kiryat Yizo. Wealth is a very good fortress. Gechoman Yizgavav Maskito. The second pasuk could have been said by anybody. Rich or poor, it's good to have money. We all know that. And so that's what the second pasuk says. It's a good pithy saying describing how one's wealth could in fact be to one's benefit. But anybody could have said that. You don't need to be Jewish, Shlomo HaMelech, or anybody else to say that second pasuk. But the first one, you do need to be a very strong Yirei Shamayim to think that one's refuge is in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So you see this time and again, the sense that Sefer Mishlei is putting its own unique stamp on what universal wisdom should be. Okay, so these are two examples of this, and there are many, many, many others throughout Sefer Mishlei. So far, what have we seen? We've seen the breakdown of the Sefer into five major sections, thus paralleling it to Torah and Tehillim. We've seen that there's a strong parallel between Sefer Mishlei and all ancient Near Eastern wisdom, but simultaneously, there are clearly defining features that are unique to Sefer Mishlei, and that shows that Mishlei has a different agenda from everybody else's wisdom. It takes human wisdom, because that's universalistic and human, but it gives it a very strong Yirat Shamayim slant. Now here are a few major themes of Sefer Mishlei. One is that the world is fair and completely comprehensible to the wise. If you study wisdom, you will now have the right colored eyeglasses through which you can view the entire world. There's a prism that you gain through having wisdom. And so the parent wants to teach the child, or the teacher wants to teach the child, learn wisdom, and then you'll be able to interpret all of life that way. That's premise number one. Premise number two is that there's no coercion here. The teacher tries very hard to show the student wisdom is good for you. You want to make the right choices because then you will live a better life. If you make the wrong choices, you will suffer. There's no question about that. So it's all about persuasion. There's no appeal to prophecy. There's no appeal to any divine knowledge. Prophecy is not claimed in our Sefer. Our tradition understands the Sefer is written Ruach HaKodesh, but it's not written through prophecy. Nobody says, Mishlei Shlomo Asher Natan Lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's no sense whatsoever that God revealed this wisdom, but rather it is the wisest of all men, Shlomo HaMelech, speaking through Ruach HaKodesh, speaking with divine inspiration. A third point, which I already mentioned, but I have to mention it again in this context, is that there's absolutely nothing about Judaism or Jewish national history at all. And by the way, this will set us up very nicely for Iyov, which similarly does not, and Kohelet, which similarly does not. These three Sfarim, more than any other Sfarim in all of Tanakh, are written to all Yirei Shamayim. They're not just written for Jews. And that's again why Rav Avraham Kavishom can say that even non-Jews have a hand in writing Sefer Mishlei. Why Yov, in all likelihood, is cast as a non-Jewish man? Because it doesn't matter. He could be righteous too, and he's suffering. And Tzadik HaRa Lo is a universal problem. It's not just limited to Jews. We might suffer more than average, unfortunately. But there's no, you know, we have no trademark on the idea of suffering. Any righteous people can suffer from any culture, and that's a problem for any Yirei Shamayim. Okay. Once you understand that, you realize that Sefer Mishlei is going to view the entire world through this lens and teach us how to do that. For example, so source number 15, Koresh Shachad Bayipol. Well, if you dig a hole, you're going to fall into it yourself. V'golel Eben Elav Kashuv. And if you roll a stone, it's going to roll right back down the hill and get you. Okay, it's a nice mashal, it's a nice proverb, it's a way of saying, if you try to harm somebody else, in fact, you will get harmed from it. What goes around comes around, all of that. Source number 16, Tzedakah Titzor Tam, and likewise, righteous behavior will protect the righteous person, Tam Darech, excuse me, one who is pure of way. V'rishah Tisalev Chatat, and similarly, the evil of a sinner will destroy the person. It's very simple, as we all know, good things happen to good people, and bad things happen to bad people, right? It says right here, and this is not the only place where it says that. Sefer Mishlei is predicated on that. So therefore, righteous behavior is good for you. Right? It's not just the right thing to do. It's not just because this is our covenant between God and Israel, or between God and Yirei Shamayim, all the different reasons why one might serve God properly, or at least aspire to that. No. You serve God because it pays off. You will live a better life. Okay, in that sense. You will be wealthier. You will live longer. All of those things, many, many psukim take that for granted and say for Mishle, because that's what wisdom teaches. Right? You understand that Eov and Kohelet, you already feel the next couple of shiurim boiling in the background. You know that they're going to say, wait, that's not true. Good, that's why you'll come back next week. But in the meantime, for our purposes, Sefer Mishle is driven by the basic premise that we can actually interpret everything through that prism. By the way, Mishle is not blind, okay? Mishle realizes that sometimes it's not always as fair as he keeps on telling you. So that's why you have psukim like source number 17 over here. Mayanir pashim akor moshchat tarig madlif nerasha. Like a muddied spring, a ruined fountain, is a righteous man fallen before a wicked one. That means that sometimes righteous people fall before the wicked, right? It doesn't say, the harder psukim are to understand in all Tanakh, among the hardest of them all, you know, it's a great Zaveka song, and we say it in Birkat HaMazon all the time, you know, nar ha'iti gam zakanti. That's very different from expressing a principle. He's saying empirically, it doesn't happen. I've never seen it happen, and it's not because you have bad eyesight, okay? But it's very much because he's saying, my experience doesn't even let me see that. That's incredible. That pasuk is very unusual in the regard of expressing reality rather than the principle. Mishle is dealing with principles. Mishle never says, I never have seen it because it doesn't happen. It's never quite that empirical, but it's much more about the principle of it. But he still grants that sometimes righteous people unfairly suffer, and that's crummy. And sometimes the wicked people are at the top of the game, and that's also crummy. And similarly, source number 18, Tov Rash Holech B'Tumo, it's better to be poor and live righteously, Me'ikesh Rachai B'Hu Ashir, than to be crooked and to be wealthy. That at least grants that sometimes wicked people are rich. Right? And at least grant that sometimes righteous people are poor. Many other psukim say, no. If you're righteous, then you'll get all the good stuff. Like, Eov pre all that horrible things that happened to him thanks to Mr. Satan, right? So there are psukim like that, but Mishle has a strategy. Mishle grants, yes, sometimes the world is unfair, but the strategy that you need to have if you have the lens of wisdom on is, you need a little bit of patience. Because by the time everybody dies, it will always be fair. Okay, always. We say this all the time, right? It's more shirli yom ha-shabbat, da-da-da. Yifroch rishayim kamo esev. Oh, when you see rishayim sprouting up and doing very well, what? Vayatizu kopal e'aben, they're doing great. What's the answer? Yishamadam adiha, don't worry, they're going down the tubes. It's short-lived success. Well, Mishle adopts that strategy as well. By the way, Kohelet is going to say, what are you talking about? Sometimes people die and they didn't suffer yet, and then it's over. The game, you know, case closed. Okay, good. So we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. But for our purposes, Sefer Mishle takes the position of many, many Mizmorei Tehillim, and just the position of classical wisdom in general, that you're right, there's temporary blips in the fair thing. Sometimes righteous people are not doing as well as they should be. Sometimes wicked people are doing way too well. Okay, just be a little patient, and before everybody dies, it will all be even out. There's nothing, no afterlife in that sentence, for a good reason. Tanakh doesn't deal with afterlife as a solution to the problem of unfairness. It's supposed to be fair in this world, according to Tanakh. So, that's why sources 19 and 20 come into play. Al tikanei b'ish hamas, v'al tibchar b'chol d'racha. Don't be jealous of the wicked one. And don't do anything that he does. Ki to'avat Hashem na'lod ve'di sharim sodo. God despises the wicked people, and in fact is very intimate. He brings them into his sod. He brings them very close, the righteous people. Me'erat Hashem be'vei rasha. Curse of God will end up in the house of the rasha. Unvei tzadikim yivarech. But the house of the tzadikim will be blessed. So don't be jealous. The assumption is, right now things might seem unbalanced. Don't worry, God will curse that guy, and God is going to bless you if you remain righteous. And therefore, it's good for you to remain righteous. And similarly, source number 20, don't be envious of the wicked people. Because it won't last. They might look like they're successful, and that might tempt you to say, oh, I should do the same thing, because I too will gain the way that they gain. Their gain is temporary, and therefore you should not pursue their way at all. There's a very common solution to the problem, and it's specifically the problem that is espoused by many Mizmorei Tehillim, including many that we say, and Sefer Mishle as a collective. And a good way to describe, there's a scholar, Michael Fox, who points out, not to be confused with the show that, you know, reminds me of when I was a teenager in Family Ties. This is Michael V. Fox as opposed to the Michael J. Fox. Okay, so Michael V. Fox, the Bible scholar, he argues that one of the most important differences between Mishlei and Kohelet, just starting to think a little more globally together with you, Mishlei does not look at the world empirically. Mishlei teaches us how to look through a lens of wisdom. Kohelet knows wisdom, but looks through the world empirically. In other words, when the Kohelet sees the righteous person suffering, that drives him bananas. Right? Or when he sees a wicked person prospering, that drives him bananas also. Whereas it doesn't drive Mishlei bananas. Mishlei just says, look, you need to be patient. You're right, it's crummy, but that's just part of the way that things are, and if you have wisdom, you'll be patient, and everything will work out very well. So, after going through some of these themes with you, and so this was this big soul-searching thing, because out of the 24 books in Tanakh, 23 of them have accompanied me into adulthood. And I find them more and more fascinating every single year. Mishlei is the one that is not. It's very personal, and I'm embarrassed to say it almost. I feel I shouldn't say that. But Mishlei hasn't come with me. I feel like it's been left at the door when I was 19 or so years old, all fired up, very idealistic, like all good yeshiva students coming, you know, learning in Israel. And at some point, it didn't resonate with me anymore. Suddenly, Iyov and Kohelet were marvelous. I got all over them, and I thought that they were just such a great and courageous response to reality. But I found that Mishlei suddenly became a foil for them. And that bothered me a lot. And it still bothers me a lot. I miss Mishlei as part of this journey, which the other 23 Sfarim are with me. I read a Sefer, whatever you want to call it, a book. Sefer, it's the Orthodox Forum, which has a conference every year, great intellectual Orthodox ones, primarily from Israel and from America. I don't think they officially discriminate against people who live in other countries besides those two, but there's no question that the overwhelming majority are either Israeli or American Aleim, and people who still currently live in America. They had a session a few years ago, I was there, on Yirat Shamayim. It's a great topic, and you could buy the book, right? The Orthodox Forum book on Yirat Shamayim. So Rav Moshe Lichtenstein is now one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Tzion, of course the son of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. He was talking about, there was a debate in this forum about what's the best way, this is a question I think about all the time, what's the best way to teach like second graders Chumash? Right? So the way I learned it was Chumash and Rashi. Go Rashi, we all love him, he's one of the greatest Mefarshim who ever lived, we're right to be all over Rashi from a very early age. But of course what ends up happening, as you all know, is Rashi ends up being part of the text. So when you finally learn about these other people like Ibn Ezra or Ramban, you don't know who they are in 6th, 7th grade, but you suddenly hear about them and they say something different from Rashi. So you don't really know who they are, right? But you know that they're wrong because they're disagreeing with the Torah. That's the way it goes. It takes a very long time to sort out, wait a minute, the reason why they're saying something different is because they disagree with somebody named Rashi. But when you're 2nd, 3rd grade, at least, you know, I wasn't able to do it, but I think many of us suffered the same problem of finding this blurring there. So there was one view in the forum saying we should actually teach Chumash a little differently, not completely with Rashi, because that will automatically require this undoing it. So Rav Moshe Lichtenstein flatly disagreed. He thought you should teach Chumash with Rashi to little children, and when they get older, you can teach Ramban and explain to them, yes, it's a machloket, and yes, there are different ways of looking at the Torah, and yes, they're debating because they both see shortcomings in each other's things. And the idea is that when you're little, you have to keep it straight. You can't start doing machloket with second graders. It's hard enough. I had a hard time understanding why Rashi wrote in such funny looking letters. It wasn't about, you know, of course, that Rashi actually did not write in what we call Rashi's script. It was just the publisher. But in the meantime, they didn't explain any of this to us in second or third grade, right? Rav Moshe Lichtenstein argued that we should teach midrashes intertwined with the text to little children because it's vivid, because it really captures the imagination, because it's educationally sound in building the religious persona. And then down the line, you teach them greater sophistication and you realize that there's such a thing called pshat and such a thing called drash, and we're able to kind of reckon with it at an older age. So that was the debate that was on the floor. And then there was a footnote in the written up article, and that's actually what got my eyes to bug out. So the point, of course, it's a very important educational debate, but he said that the analogy of what he's trying to describe is Mishlei is for children and Iyov is for adults. So I'm like, wait a second here. I know that that's how I'm feeling also, and I'm struggling with it, but it pains me that I feel that way, right? I don't think it's okay to just say Mishle is for kids. Mishle is in Tanakh, and therefore it's supposed to accompany us through our whole adulthood also. We don't say there's a book in Tanakh that you're supposed to outgrow. Right? Which is what the footnote was suggesting. The idea is that Mishle is the children's approach, and Iyov is the adult's approach. Which again is how I might personally feel, but I don't think that that's good. I struggle with this particular problem. So what you do in this situation when you're tormented by this question anyway, and now you see a prominent Rosh Yeshiva saying the same thing, is you email Rabbi Shalom Carmi. At least that's what I do. Rabbi Carmi is a teacher of mine, you know, for many, many years, you know, both in college, but I've found over the years that, you know, as much as you need teachers when you're a student, you need them much, much, much more when you are a teacher. So Rabbi Carmi is, as I've only, you know, he's only become a greater teacher to me as the years have gone on. And I emailed him, you know, back in 2008. I'm like, Rabbi Carmi, I just read this thing and I read the footnote and sounds to me like you're saying that Mishle is a sefer that you can outgrow. And so, what do you make of that? So his response was, look, this is a direct quote from the email, right? Pshat is hospitable. Mishle, after all, addresses my son. And the Sitzin Leben, you leave it to Rabbi Carmi in a two-sentence email to make sure to mention Sitzin Leben, which means the setting, the life setting of the sefer may be the school. And in fact, that is what it sounds like. It sounds like a parent is addressing a child. It does sound like a teacher is addressing school children. My guts are, of course, against it for frum reasons. How can you say that Dvar Hashem is for children? But in this case, truth may trump frumkeit. So he actually, in his classic way of formulating a situation, is actually saying something very similar, which is, there should be something wrong with saying that Mishle is an outgrowable sefer, because no sefer in Tanakh should be outgrowable. But at the same time, the sefer itself is addressed to children. That is, in fact, how the sefer was written, and that creates this very interesting thing. Baruch Hashem, I'm very, very blessed that many of my students have themselves become teachers now and rabbis, and they're busy out there teaching stuff. So I'm in contact with a lot of them. You know, they email questions, we discuss all these sorts of things. Whenever they teach Mishle, I right away jump out of, you know, you hear me getting all enthusiastic in the email saying, okay, what do you do? Tell me your secret. If you're teaching it effectively, maybe I can figure out a way to do it myself. So the response 100% of the time, 100, okay, is I can't teach the text, so I teach it on a deeper level. Okay, so I'm like, what does that mean? So, you know, the text goes to the deeper level. So do you mean you just pick a parshan, let's say Malbim, and just do Malbim? In which case, that's great, but then you're just teaching Malbim. You're not teaching Mishle anymore. So it's fine, Malbim is good, we should all learn him too. But that's not the same thing as what I'm trying to drive at, which is, can you teach the text effectively at a high level? And that's something I've not figured out a way to do based on that. So one approach, which again, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein is suggesting, and Rabbi Carmi is definitely playing it out as well, is the possibility that yes, Mishle actually is in Tanakh as a means of educating younger children, and that's the baseline, and that Iyov and Kohelet are going to bring us up to adult speed. In which case, my struggles are justified, because that's the point. But I'm still struggling. I don't feel cured by this answer. Another approach, which I'm actually more satisfied by, is that Tanakh is always rooted in a certain dialectic. And I'm not just saying that because I went to YU and we hear a solid basic dialectic all the time, right? It's really true. It's there. The idea is that Chazal, actually, when they want to talk about a stable structure, they talk about a three-legged stool. The idea that you need all three legs, and that's what gives it its stability. I think of much of Tanakh as a two-legged stool, where you don't have that stability. Mishle is one pole, and Iyov and Kohelet are going to be that other pole. And Mishle is going to tell us, here's what wisdom says and teaches, and we should look through it. And Iyov and Kohelet are going to say, but wisdom isn't right. And we're going to argue with you. And then Mishle is going to say, what are you talking about? This is wisdom. And Iyov and Kohelet are not there to disagree for the sake of rejecting it. They accept wisdom also, and that's what makes Tanakh so powerful in this case, and that's what I'm so excited about this series for. From that point of view, Mishle represents a series of principles of what we would think of as the religious party line. It's the baseline of religious teaching in Tanakh. With Iyov and Kohelet then jumping out and saying, empirical reality does not match that. Now what do we do? And how do we develop religiously given this particular conflict, which of course, you and I are not the first people to think about this conflict. It's the problem that Tanakh has created. And I'll close the shiur just with the concept of theodicy. Theodicy, in a nutshell, is the justification of God's judgment. And the idea is that Torah addressed or answered every major question that's ever been raised religiously. It's amazing what the Torah has done. And we're always very grateful for that and so many other aspects of the Torah. But it created this one problem. If God is all the omnis, and God cares about our actions and is fair and judges our ways and sees our ways, well then God needs to bat 1,000 because after all, God is God. And if there's a single exception to fairness or what God's promises are, we got a problem. It can't be that God bats 950. You don't get to be God batting 950. You have to bat 1,000. And that is the problem. The word theodicy itself, I'm actually very grateful to for another reason. You know, there's a game called Boggle where you shake the cubes. I used to play this with my sister a lot when we were in high school. I generally beat her and, of course, enjoyed that little part of the game. She was very good. Now I can't beat her anymore. But at the time, you know, it mattered. I beat her almost every game, except for those low-scoring games. Occasionally she'd beat me 3-2 or whatever with some little word that I somehow missed or whatever it was. But for the big-scoring games, I always got her. One game, we had a big-scoring game and she beat me. But I had theodicy. And I was pretty sure it was a word. I just learned it recently. And it's 8 letters long. And if you play the game, it's 11 points. It's a lot of points. And specifically, it was enough points to put me over the top. So she, of course, accused me of being somewhat sore and just making up words because I was desperate to salvage the game. I'm like, no. I'm pretty sure theodicy is a word. I just learned it recently. Why don't we look it up? So she didn't even want to humor me. We looked it up. And, of course, thank God it was there. And that proves that good things happen to good people. I think it does. But in a broader, so I'm still very grateful to theodicy for that. But of course it also is the great problem created by the Torah. Mishlei tries to adopt the strategy of the world really is fair, and even if you don't see it, be patient for a little while and it will all even out. Eov and Kohelet are going to come flying at that very, very strongly. And that's what these next two sessions are going to be. I thank you all for coming. There's going to be a little time for Q&A. I think that's the goal of all of this. But in the meantime, I just wanted to thank you once again for having me at the Young Israel to make us safe again, Fachberg and Avi for all of his help in putting it together. And thank you all for coming. It shows that there's such a great thirst for understanding Tanakh and learning it at a deeper level. I'm delighted to be able to do more of that with you.
I want to read that footnote just sort of on the surface. The way I would interpret it is to say that when you teach Mishlei, it's sort of set up at a basic level to teach the children. When you read Kohelet, you can't really teach that to children, even though there is no basic level. Mishlei on the basic level is for children. That doesn't mean that there's not a higher level. I don't see the footnote as being sort of contradicting the context.
It depends how you understand Mishlei. In other words, if you link the so-called deeper level to the text itself and show how one comes from the other, then for sure I agree. He's arguing that Pshutosh HaMikra actually does take a child's level. And so you can disagree with it. As soon as I figure out a way to disagree with that substantially, that's the day I'm going to give the course. Right? In other words, as soon as I feel, okay, the deeper level really emanates from the text itself rather than just brilliant parshanut, which is weaving in other things which are also good, but not Mishlei, well then there's a dichotomy and then it's not the deeper level anymore. Then it's just teachings that you and I find more appealing, but not different Mishlei. So that's exactly what we got to work with. Somebody else, yeah.
If going back to the earlier section, if Mishlei is actually written by multiple writers, some of which who potentially were Jewish,
right?
Is not the Pesukim at the end where they contradict one after another be broken by author so that they wouldn't be juxtaposed next to one another, but the Jewish ones would be attributed to Shlomo and the sort of generic universal ones attributed to different writers?
Even if that were so, I mean, I can't tell you no, but even if that were so, that doesn't answer the fact that whoever put it together into its final form is putting it next to it. You know, what we care about is the final product. Even if there is such a process where there was a collection of non-Jewish Mishalim that were then woven into a Yirat Shamayim framework, which is what it seems to be the case, but still, the bottom line is that the final product is now Sefer Mishlei with Ruach HaKodesh. So in other words, you're right that there's an earlier stage in the process, which we don't know, But it still leaves us with the product that we have.
Are the proverbs attributed after those Pesukim introducing the writer of a certain tone which differ from the others?
Some scholars try to sort out, like, is Agur different from what you saw with the Shlomo collections? Because there's so little material, in other words, the Agur thing is a parak, as opposed to 29 prakim that are Shlomo, it's hard to, it could be that those psukim are slightly different, and Eshet Chayil is radically different from everything else in the Sefer. That doesn't mean that Lemuel had a different philosophy. It could just be, okay, he's putting in this wonderful thing about either the typological ideal woman, or that that is already a mashal to wisdom itself, which are, you know, there are different ways of looking at it. So it's hard to know because we have insufficient information. Yeah.
Are there those who contend that Mishlei is just the more simplistic view, Shlomo maybe in his early life, and then later a more nuanced, sophisticated view of life and wisdom and realizing that things just don't necessarily... isn't there a juxtaposition of that? It shows his development?
There is a Midrash which lots of people like because it's so humanly appealing, right? That he wrote Shir HaShirim when he was very young and he was all romantic and, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and then he wrote Mishlei when he had sober wisdom and he was like 40-ish, and then Kohelet he wrote when he was an old bitter man, right? So it's in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, I'm not making this up. And then there's another view right there in the same Midrash that says he wrote all of them when he was old. So when I teach any Shlomo material in Shiurim, I say the worst thing you could do is to subjectify it into Shlomo's biography, because then you lose the universal import of it. In other words, Shir HaShirim could be written by anybody. I mean, it's written by Shlomo, but I'm saying it could be written by somebody who's young. It could also be written by somebody who is old. I think the same is true with Mishlei, and I think it's also true with Kohelet. Meaning, in principle, Shlomo HaMelech could have written all three of them on the same day. Whether as a young man or an old man, Barbanel was able to write pretty fast also, so maybe Shlomo could too. But in the meantime, the point is that I don't think it's helpful to learn Mishlei as, oh, he said this when he was younger, and then he himself outgrew it. He could have said them on the same day, and one is meant for children, or not, and it's just a pole, and one is meant for adults, or that both of them are two poles of the baseline versus the challenge to the baseline. In other words, you and I could have this conversation with Mishlei and Kohelet at our current age and not say, oh, 30 years ago we would have thought about it differently. We could really do it. Yeah.
I think there's something to be said that aside from the writer, but the reader is bifurcated or trifurcated, however you want to say it. Any particular, doesn't psychology talk about the inner child? So Mishlei could be speaking to an adult, the inner child of the adult.
I agree. In other words, that was my second approach to the Mishlei of Kohelet continuum, is exactly that, meaning that we all should retain this inner child, so to speak, which then speaks to the adult. I mean, Rav Soloveitchik, in this new, I don't want to call it a commentary because he didn't write it as a commentary, it's an anthologizing of his works on Sefer Bereishit by Arnold Lustiger, so we just had a book reception for it last week in New Rochelle. And so one of his good vortlach that I really liked was Sarah being, 127 years, but how does it say it? Sheva Shana, Sreim Shana, Mea Shana, right? It's a strange formulation. So Soloveitchik makes exactly your point. That Sarah Imenu's greatness was that she always retained the 7-year-old. She always had that pristineness. She always had the 20-year-old, the vibrancy. And she always had the wisdom of a 100-year-old. And obviously he's describing a typology of the ideal human being, somebody who's able to have all of them. So I agree with you. I think that the second reading of what Mishlei versus Eov and Kohelet is meant to do is exactly that it's always supposed to be a part of us, even if it doesn't grow the same way as Eov and Kohelet do, going back to John's question as well.
What comes up is about the name Mishlei, which always meant to me. So the word Mashal, I mean, it's always translated proverbs, but Mishlei doesn't mean proverbs. Mishlei means parables. And Mashal by nature means it's multi-layered. So, as one who sometimes uses stories in my drushes, there always is a story, and if you remember the story, take that home, you could apply that to many different levels. So even though Mishlei can be understood by a child, an adult looking at Mishlei will see many different layers if they look at it carefully. On the other hand, Kohelet, you can't look at it as a child because it's kind of hopeless. You can only look at it multi-layered. So the fact that it's called Mishlei to me means you can look at the simple level, recognize that these are all Mishlei, and you have to try and figure out what it means deeper, which is much more complicated, I think, than figuring out Kohelet or Eov, because those are more like, they stare in your face what the messages probably are.
Mm-hmm.
And Mishlei is always like trying to figure it out as a marshal.
Right, just to bolster and strengthen Rabbi Hafler's point, Mishlei actually can mean proverbs. In other words, it's not a faulty translation. It also could mean parable. And I think that only highlights that it could be read as Proverbs, and simultaneously one could look for deeper Rav Pinchas of Plotz, getting back to that term paper that took me a long time to track down. He thinks the whole thing is a mashal. In other words, he tries to figure out which narratives in the Torah these things are really based on, and then he has it's a brilliant paper, and it's rooted in the premise that it's not just what meets the eye, but rather there's something else going on, and that of course takes a lot more work and ingenuity.
Can you just say a few words? I realized that as he was speaking about that, multiple authors in Mishlei that another taker has a similar thing, and that's Stephen, and they also have multiple authors, although we attribute it all to David. And is there any reason that these two particular ones were singled out, that they have multiple authors trying to put the thing at a specific theme, or perhaps could it have been you could have had a single Tehillim win with 75 Brachim in it for Gaon, and one could have accomplished a fair amount as well. It sounds like Mishlei could have been just done by Shlomo's wisdom without other people. But what you're really saying is that the decision was made to add to it and make it less personal.
Well, the issue isn't personal. Again, even if it's all Shlomo, it's still not personal. He's giving us wisdom that's universally applicable, right? In other words, it's not about him, it's about all Yirei Shamayim and how they should learn. Same is true of Tehillim. By the way, when we say we ascribe it all to David, it depends who we is, right? In other words, there certainly is a traditional view that has constricted the authors of Tehillim into one, but the Gemara and Bava Batra takes for granted that there's 10 plus David. There are other Midrashic sources that dated all the way down to Ezra, and so we definitely see within the text itself, we need not assume that it's all David, and in fact it's counterproductive in certain instances to assume David when the word David is not anywhere in the Mizmor, and it's just, we're all the greater for it. The idea of having Tefillah is infinite, and the idea that Tehillim, Sefer Tehillim, is so vast that it covers every possible range of human emotions is what makes Tehillim Tehillim. There's a reason why it speaks to us today. And the same is true with Mishlei. Mishlei is so profoundly wise in what it's trying to teach. If everybody just did what he said, the world would be phenomenal. Right? And so that's why the baseline of wisdom is so important. Like, as much as intellectually there's some myths, and that was the whole point of the child element of this shiur, it's still all good and still all very valuable. The only issue is what happens when it comes into conflict with the perceived reality that all people have. That's why you need an Eov and correlate as well. Okay, with that, I just want to, we'll call it a night for tonight, but once again, thank you so much for coming out in your busy schedules, and I look forward to resuming our learning together with Sefer Eov next Sunday.